Good morning, everybody. It's Friday. Hopefully, we'll have a nice weekend doing your homework and stuff like that. So, by the way, there will be office hours. So, I will have office hours today at 3:30 to 4, or, you know, if need be, longer. I am in the office 3:80. And then, before the tutorial, Ghazal will have office hours, so from 1 to 2 today, if you have any questions. And then you are in which room?
She sends an email.
Three seven. There is a number here. Okay, so you will find Ghazal. So that's from 1 to 2 today, and then if you still have some questions, then from 3:30 to 4, it will be me in that room over there.
Monday's tutorial also. From 1 to 2. Hopefully, by then you have finished
it. So of course. The purpose is that you address all difficult questions to Ghazal and to Sotiris and leave me only the nice, simple questions, okay? All right, so let's now do a new topic in differential geometry, and that is parallel transport and geodesics. And the first concept, which is very, very intuitive, is that of an integral curve, okay? So imagine that you have your manifold, and on that manifold, the manifold is penetrated by some nice curves, which are parameterized by, let's say, each of these curves is parameterized by its own parameter lambda. And, you know, these curves are not intersecting, they are smoothly, nicely. You can think about like water flowing in the river without any curls and stuff like that. And so then it's obvious that to each of these curves, at every point, I can find the tangent vector field. Okay, so at every point, I can find the tangent vector, which will be, tangent to that curve here. And why you can do that is that you get a very simple formula, is that, you know, let's say this curve gamma is parameterized by x mu of lambda, and what you require is that your tangent vector field, u mu, is simply given by the derivative in given coordinate system x mu over d lambda, right? So this is what you... So for every curve x mu, I can find its derivative, and that will be the components of that vector, which is tangent to that curve, right? However, it's also obvious that I can reverse the problem. I can say, well, what if I have nice smooth vector field on my manifold U? Okay, so then am I able to find the corresponding curves, which so that this vector field is tangent to these curves? And precisely, you have to solve the same equation, but now for different unknowns. So this is given to you, and now you are finding, you know, what is the parametrization of that curve gamma. So you can go both ways. It's a linear equation, and you can solve it both ways. If I know this, I can solve that. If I know this, I can solve that. Right? So, so the curves, which are tangent, hose the integral curve is a curve so that for a given vector field, the curve is always tangent to the vector field, okay? And these are called integral curves. And you can solve it both ways. So it's solve both ways. And in one way, it gives you the vector field. If you solve it the other way, it gives you the integral curve. And because it's a linear equation, it always has a solution. Okay, so there's basically one-to-one map between the vector fields on the manifold and the smooth tangent curves, integral curves on that manifold. Very good. So then once we have, okay, so we have a curve, and then it need not be an integral curve, but let's say that it is an integral curve because there's a one-to-one correspondence. And then what you can do is that you can parallel transport things along this curve, which means I take any object, you know, at that point, let's say it's a vector, and then I carry that object along the curve, and I get another vector. Okay? So now the aim of the parallel transport is that if you are in flat space and Minkowski coordinates, the components of this vector do not change. So you really like carry vector so that nothing is changing along a curve, and you get the same vector over there. Okay, so that's the effect of parallel transport. So consider curve gamma, which is an integral curve, so it's parameterized by some parameter lambda. And let this be an integral curve of some vector field u. Okay. Then you define a covariant derivative along gamma as covariant derivative along gamma of vector B as so now there's a capital D, and this is how you denote this. So you're carrying, well, you're transporting these components of the vector field V, and it's simply given by the covariant derivative along the corresponding vector field V alpha. So that's a definition. So you take a covariant derivative of this V, and then you project it along this vector field U. It's like a directional derivative, but now covariant directional derivative of V alpha. Sometimes people just write nabla along the vector U, which is the same thing. It's just a definition of what you mean by nabla U of V alpha. And sometimes, because there is a parameter lambda here, which looks like time, but it need not be time. But anyway, sometimes people just write V alpha dot. So all these possible notations are possible, OK? But what is it? So if you think about it, so this is equal to u mu. And now you have to plug in the expression for the covariant derivative. Right, so it will be not partial mu alpha, and then gamma mu beta alpha v beta. I'm just plugging what the covariant derivative is. But what is this guy here? So this is. This thing here is dx mu over d lambda, right? That's how we defined our vector field, which is tangent to our curve. So this is dx mu over d lambda. And this thing here is dv alpha over dx mu, right? So you see that I can actually do this. So what's written here is dv alpha over d lambda. And this is what it is. Okay, so that's what covariant derivative along vector along the curve gamma is. And you see that it's basically like you differentiate the components with respect to that parameter parameterizing your curve, but you have also correction due to these Christoffel symbols there. Okay. So now you say that V is parallel transported if this is zero. Okay, so V alpha is parallel transported if parallel transported along the curve gamma, right? Parallel transported if this guy is equal to zero. Which means that equation is equal to zero. So now, let me just draw one more picture here. So this is your gamma of lambda. That is your vector field u, which is tangent to that, u mu, and so on, right? And then you are parallel transporting vector v alpha, right? So you take this vector and you carry it along this curve, and you get some different v alpha here, and different v alpha there, and so on. So that's what you are doing. You are just moving this vector field along this thing here. You are parallel transporting it when this thing is equal to zero. But what does it actually mean? What are you trying to do? So if you are in Minkowski space in Cartesian coordinates, what happens to these gamma? They vanish. Right? So if you are in Minkowski and Cartesian coordinates, this is zero. And then you are saying if I'm parallel transporting vector v, then dv, the components do not change along gamma. So really the vector v will be the same everywhere. It will have exactly the same components everywhere along the vector. So it is for like the most general, it's a generalization of, you know, the fact that I want to carry the vector not changing if you are not in Cartesian coordinates, the gammas will be non-trivial, or if you are not in Minkowski space, and then it will be tilting. So that the total thing, gamma plus a partial derivative, is equal to zero. Okay, so it's like, so we want to preserve the alpha along gamma as much as possible. So that's the meaning of the parallel transport. Right? And it will be exactly preserved if you are in Cartesian coordinate in Minkowski space, but it won't be exactly preserved because what you require is this thing here. Yes?
Just look intuitively, if I have a sphere, does that mean that it's going to go?
Very good. You will see. Thank you for that question. You will see in 10 minutes or something like that what's happening there. Mm-hmm. Is this clear? Is this very intuitive? Very intuitive, right? So now, definition. What is a geodesic? So geodesic is a curve along which the tangent vector is parallel transported. Which means dv alpha over d lambda equals to zero, which means v beta, lambda beta, v alpha equals to zero. Okay? So now you have a special curve in your space-time, such that, of course, this special curve has its tangent vector, but what is nice about this tangent vector, that the tangent vector obeys this equation dv alpha over d lambda along its own curve, it's equal to zero. Okay, so that's what geodesic is. And what basically this means is that geodesic is like a generalization of straight line. If you have straight line, the tangent vector, is the same everywhere, but the components of the tangent vector do not change as you transport it that curve, and so that's precisely what a straight line would have. Okay, so it's a generalization of straight line in some sense. We shall see later that also geodesic is something which typically extremizes the distance between the two points. So either it minimizes the distance between the two points, or it actually maximizes the, because of the signature of the metric, it may maximize or extremize in general the distance between the two points. And in general, ultimately, the two concepts, that it's a generalization of straight line, and at the same time, it's an extremization between the distance between the two points, they are the same. Okay, the geodesics will be the same. If you have more general theory of gravity, you have two types of geodesics. One that generalizes the straight line, and another which generalizes the minimal distance. Right? So in the general theory of differential geometry, you have two different concepts. In general relativity, where there is no torsion and there is no metricity, the two concepts will be the same. Okay. Very good. So this is... this is what geodesic means. However, what I am doing here to describe my geodesic is some parameter lambda, right? So you have gamma of lambda. So just beware that, of course, I don't need to use one particular lambda. So lambda just tells me, lambda is equal to 1 here, equal to 2 here, 3, 4, 6, whatever. It's some parameter which parametrizes my curve, right? What can happen is that I can go from lambda to some new parameter, lambda tilde. Okay. In general, if you go from parameter lambda to arbitrary function of lambda, right? So this lambda tilde may be arbitrary function of lambda. Then what will happen is that this equation is not preserved. Okay. What will happen in general is that you will find that this is now lambda tilde is equal to some function here, something, v alpha. Okay, so the geodesic equation is not exactly, reparametrization invariant. If you reparametrize your parameter, the geodesic equation changes. But this is the most general form the geodesic equation can take. The parallel transport of that vector is proportional to the vector itself, times to some function, which is the function of proportionality. Okay, but if you find that your favorite vector satisfies this equation, it means you are describing a geodesic. It also means that you are stupid because you are not using the right parameter lambda. You are using some much more complicated parameter lambda, but there will be a better parameter lambda, better parametrization of your geodesic, so that the right-hand side can vanish. So this can always be reparametrized. And hence brought to this form over here. And so it's typical that people only consider this form here because they always assume that you are clever enough that you can find the right parametrization of your geodesic. And so that the geodesic obeys this equation over here. Okay, it's simple to show that you will get this term here. Just plug in lambda tilde, which is an arbitrary function of lambda, and you will see that this equation will rewrite as that equation. Okay. Questions. So we have geodesics. We have beautiful things which are like generalization of the straight line at this point. Okay. So once you have geodesic, you may be asking, is something preserved along the geodesic? So let's say my geodesic describes the motion of the particle, right? Is angular momentum of that particle preserved? Or is energy of the particle preserved? And stuff like that. So are there any conserved quantities associated with the geodesic? Okay. And so first look at conserved quantities in GR. In this case, it will be for geodesics. So let me consider that we can form a function, well, C, which will be a projection of your geodesic vector. So let's say we have a geodesic. Okay, so let's have a geodesic with tangent vector u mu. So really, this satisfies this thing here. U mu nabla mu u nu equals to 0. Okay, so this is our geodesic. And let's form a quantity which is u mu times psi mu, where this is some vector field. Okay, why not? Let's have a vector field psi mu. Let's contract it with my geodesic tangent vector u mu. And let's call this quantity C. So now you may be asking, well, this looks like a constant. That's why I call it C. Well, what would be the conditions that this is indeed a constant for every geodesic? Okay, so if C to be a constant for every geodesic, then what do we require? We require that as you parallel transport the C quantity along the geodesic, the value of the C does not change. Right? If it's an energy, the energy of the particle has to be the same if the particle is here or if it evolves over there, it's still the same energy, right? So this thing here cannot actually change as you move along the geodesic, which means that C dot, as you transport it along the geodesic, must be zero. What is C dot? Well, that's this, you know, u mu nabla mu on C, right? So it was just the definition of what I meant by dot. I parallel transport it along the geodesic. Okay, so what is that? It's u mu nabla mu. And then what do we have here? Okay, let me change the indices. U nu psi nu, right? So that's how I define my C. Very good. I have to differentiate two things in the bracket. I use the Leibniz rule, as always. So this is equal to u mu, u nu, nabla mu, psi nu. I differentiated the second one and left the first one untouched. And plus u mu, nabla mu, u nu, and then psi nu. I differentiate the first one. Can we simplify this? What about the second term?
Isn't that zero?
Because?
It's a geodesic.
It's a geodesic, right? So this is our assumption. We have a geodesic, right? So we have a geodesic. This is zero. So this thing here must be zero. By assumption. What about the first term? Look at this. So this thing and that thing, UU is the same object. Again, if you swap these two, it's the same thing. So this thing here is symmetric in mu and nu. Okay? If I had some antisymmetric part here, symmetric times antisymmetric is zero. Is that clear to everybody? Symmetric times antisymmetric is zero? Is there anybody who has a problem with that? Okay. So that means that only symmetric part here contributes. So I can symmetrize over these two indices, and it will still be the same thing. Right? Well, if this is to be zero for any u mu, for any geodesic, the only possibility is that this thing here is zero. So the vector field psi, which I introduced over here, has to be very, very special. It has to satisfy an equation that nabla mu psi nu symmetrized over the indices is equal to 0. Okay? So if I require this for every geodesic, then it means that nabla mu psi nu plus nabla nu psi mu must be equal to 0. Not every field psi will satisfy this equation. This is called killing vector equation. Okay. So if you can find in your spacetime such a vector field psi so that it satisfies this equation, then for every geodesic, this quantity over here will be a constant of motion. It will be an integral of motion. It will be preserved. Example, if your spacetime is independent of the time coordinate, it's static, there's no time dependence whatsoever, you intuitively think the energy should be conserved. The statement is, if it is time independent, psi will be precisely this vector along the dt direction, and this quantity here will have a meaning of conserved energy. If the spacetime is axisymmetric, there will be such killing vector field, psi, so that this is precisely along the d phi direction along the rotation. And this quantity here will be conserved angular momentum, and so on. Okay, so this is the simplest way how we can arrive at the killing vector equation. And the statement is that we have basically using here the Noether's theorem. So killing vector equations, the corresponding killing vectors describe symmetries of spacetime. And once you have such a killing vector field in your spacetime, your spacetime will have that symmetry. By Noether's theorem, there will be the corresponding conserved quantity. And this is the corresponding conserved charge. This is the Noether charge. For that symmetry. Okay? So now I haven't shown that this is a symmetry of the spacetime. I was just saying, well, okay, I want this to be a conserved quantity. I want this to be a charge. And so I gave you an ansatz for this, what it could be, and I derived that this actually has to be satisfied. So now, in your tutorial, next week probably, you will show that indeed, this guy here is a symmetry of the metric, right? That this is a precise direction along which you have to move, so that the metric, the space-time itself, does not change. This is indeed a space-time system, so describes a space-time symmetry. Let me stress that. Space-time symmetry. Which means that along that special direction, the metric is not changing. And you will do that in your tutorial. This is much harder to show. That's why you are doing it in your tutorial. And that's why I'm doing the simplest thing over here in the lecture. Right? This is the fastest way how you arrive at the killing vector equation. But it doesn't give you the fact that actually it is the symmetry of the metric. You will show in your tutorial that it is the symmetry of the metric. Questions?
Could you explain again why we were able to symmetrize the mu and
v? Okay, very good. So there is a statement. If you have symmetric object and you have anti-symmetric object, so this is symmetric here in these two indices, and this is anti-symmetric in these two indices, you should get 0. Okay? Everybody happy with this statement? Well, how you do that? So this is equal to 0. Because I can always swap the two indices. And if I swap these two indices, I get a minus sign. Okay? So this is equal to S alpha beta minus S alpha beta A beta alpha. Right? Because I swap the two indices. This is anti-symmetric. I pick up a minus sign. I can swap these two indices as well. But because this guy is symmetric, nothing changes. So I can write this as S beta alpha, right? So far, so good. There's a minus of that. But now I can rename the index. This is just a dummy index that I'm summing over. So I can call this index alpha and call this index beta. So this is minus S alpha beta A alpha beta. Right, I just renamed the indices. But you see that this is minus that. And the only possibility is that it's zero. Okay, so if you are symmetric times anti-symmetric, it is equal to zero. So what it means is that here, this object here, is symmetric in mu and nu. If this had some anti-symmetric part, well, it's automatically zero. I don't care about that. So the only thing which may contribute is the symmetric part. So if I symmetrize here, that's the non-trivial contribution I can be getting here, right? So that symmetric part has to be equal to zero. If there is anti-symmetric, I don't care. Okay, very good. So now somebody asked about the metricity. Yes?
Is psi mu a vector field or a covector field? Because
Very good, very good. So here, as I have written it, it will be a covector, right? And so it is here, right? So here, it's like a one form here. But now, from now on, we are actually in the metric space where you have metric. And you can always write an index with the metric. And so typically, people like to call it killing vectors. Like, so they write the index, and they put psi mu up. And actually, when you write it psi mu up, it's typically much simpler. So really, what you would call a vector killing vector is this psi mu. And for example, if you know your space-time is static, it's just you are moving along the time direction. And this will be your vector field. And that's super nice when you have index up, right? If you lower the index, it may be more difficult. So typically people think about killing vectors like real vectors here, but it doesn't matter really, because now you are in the metric space and you can lower or raise index.
So Z space-time symmetry is like derivative along epsilon vectors, right? And I have also one question. So another question, sorry. So both u and like this space-time symmetry is dependent on knowledge of metric, right? And like so for example, like in stationary space-time, so we assume without knowing, because we have to solve for metric, right, in GR.
Okay.
So we assume that like existence of this vector field.
That's right. So you know, when you are trying to solve the Einstein equations, they are very difficult. Right? So typically, what people are able to solve Einstein equations only in very symmetric situations. Let's say I have a spherically symmetric object. Right? So in that case, I have all spherical symmetries there. I can rotate here. I can rotate there, and so on. So that simplifies your solution of Einstein equations. If I assume all these symmetries, metric has to take a very, very special form. And then I can solve the Einstein equations. So that's how you arrive at the metric. But what we are doing here is, let's say we are going the other way around. We already have a metric. And the question is, does this metric has any symmetry? And if you write the metric in some obscure coordinates, it's not clear at all that it may have even Minkowski metric, right? I write it in some very weird, I invent a horrible 10, 20 page coordinate transformation, right? And then I transform my metric into these new coordinates, and it's not obvious at all that it will have some symmetries, right? But the statement is, if you can solve this equation, and if you can find this vector field psi, which satisfies this equation, that will be the symmetry of the metric. Okay. Okay. So now back to metricity. So somebody asked what could be the meaning of metricity, and I don't really have the answer to geometrical meaning, but let me just show you one simple statement. So let B and W be two parallel transported vectors along gamma. B two parallel transported vectors along gamma is tangent vector u. Okay? So what we are assuming is that nabla u of v is equal to 0, and it's nabla u of w is equal to 0. Okay, so that's your assumption. Then you may be asking, what happens to the scalar product of the two vectors? Okay, let's say that they are normalized. Well, okay, if they are normalized, so v square is 1, w square is 1, then if you take the scalar product of the two vectors, it just gives you a cosine theta between the two vectors. It gives you how a scalar product of the two vectors gives you the cosine theta between them, right? So now you may be asking, what happens with this cosine theta? What happens with this theta, which they are in between them, as you move it along this geodesic as well? Okay, so you do d over d lambda v times w. Okay, so what is a scalar product? Scalar product is a metric thing. Okay, so you basically feed your v and w to the metric, and that's what gives you the scalar product. So this is d over d lambda, and what it is v alpha, w beta, g alpha beta. So that's what scalar product means. Okay. But what is this? So this thing here, again, Leibniz rule, I have to differentiate this guy, I have to differentiate that guy, I have to differentiate that guy. If I differentiate the first guy, what happens?
Zero.
It's zero by this assumption over here. I'm using different notations just to confuse you, okay? You should be getting used to all the possible notations. So if I act on this guy here, it's zero. What if I act on that guy here? Also zero. So the only thing which can be non-trivial is when I act on that guy. So this thing here is v alpha, w beta, and let me change again the notation, u gamma, nabla gamma, g alpha beta. That's what it is. And so this thing here is the metricity. So now if you are setting metricity equal to 0, this will be 0. If m is equal to 0. So the requirement on 0 metricity will mean that if you parallel transport two vectors along some curve gamma, no matter how they change, like how they rotate and whatever, the angle in between them is not changing. That's what zero metricity gives you. So the angle remains angle between two parallel transported vectors. So angle does not change. The angle between the two vectors does not change. Okay, and that's the physical, that's the geometrical meaning of metricity, if you want. Like, if I want this to be true, so the vectors can still rotate widely and do whatever, do many, many things, but the angle in between them, if both of them are parallel transported, will always remain the same. The cosine theta does not change. Yeah?
You mentioned cosine theta many times during this, but isn't this statement true only in Euclidean geometry? So, in general, we don't have the analog of the cosine?
Of course. If you go beyond Euclidean, it will be like a definition, if you want. So I can define my cosine theta to be v times w. So you're absolutely right. So yeah. Okay, very good. So now let me draw. Well, what does it mean in particular, right? In particular, it means that so specifically, if I just consider, one vector v, which is parallel transported along u, along gamma, described by vector u, And the picture is, well, my u is always tangent here. But if v is parallel transported, v here, well, this is not good. Let's say this is u. I want them to look different. Okay. So this is u. This is my tangent vector for this curve. And it's a geodesic, okay? So this is a geodesic. So really, u is parallel transported along this gamma, okay? So then, if I have the vector v here, then this is that angle. And then if I want to know how the vector v looks like later, the angle has to be preserved. So then the vector v will look like that, and will look like that, and so on, so that the angle is always preserved between the tangent vector to my geodesic and that vector v. Okay? So this is very simple. It's a direct consequence of this. Very good. So now, let's consider Euclidean space. So E2 with the Euclidean metric. And let's draw a triangle there. Okay. These are straight lines, okay? Now it's straight line, almost straight line. Very good. So straight lines are geodesics in Euclidean space. Right? So the tangent vector to this thing here. So these are all geodesics, right? Geodesics. And so is this one here. Okay, so triangle is made of geodesics, of straight lines. Okay? So now let's say I start parallel transporting a vector which looks like this. Okay? And I parallel transport it first along this geodesic, then along that geodesic, and then back along that geodesic. What will happen? So the angle has to be preserved. So if I am parallel transporting along this geodesic, then it has to, so there's a 90 degree here. So I have to have 90 degree here, and so on. So the vector will look like this there. This is an up line there. Okay, so there's still 90 degrees here. Now I parallel transport along this geodesic. Well, there's a zero angle between tangent vector and my vector. So in the end, when I parallel transport it here, it will look like this. It will be parallel to my tangent vector there. Finally, I parallel transport along this. Again, I have to preserve the angle. So this angle has to be preserved. This angle has to be preserved. And it's the same angle as over here. I come back as I go along this loop here. I come back to the same vector field. Okay? So as I parallel transport B along this closed loop given by my geodesics here, I get to the same vector V. Okay? We have same vector after doing a loop. And this is very intuitive, right? You parallel transport a vector along geodesics, you get to the same vector. Why not? Right? Let's do the same thing, but now on the sphere. Okay? So now we do it on a sphere. So what you can show, let's say, that the geodesics on the sphere are the things which really are the shortest things between the two points, and they are the great circles on the sphere. They are the thing which actually, so the geodesics will be the great circles. You can show that. Okay? So geodesics are the great circles. Okay, so now, what will be an analog of a triangle on the sphere? So it will be something which connects 3 points, and it connects these 3 points through these great circles. Okay? So let me start, for example, here. That's 1 point. There's another point. And then let me go all the way to the North Pole. And so then I'll plot like a, so this would be like a great circle here, right? So that this would be one part of the triangle, and then there would be another great circle over there, and then this thing over here. So this is your generalization of the triangle on the sphere. Okay. For now, this is geodesic. That is geodesic. That is geodesic. It's a part of great circle on the sphere. Very good. So now, let's start paratransporting again the vector, which looks like this. Okay, that's my vector v. So I want to preserve the angle. I'm parallel transporting. Perfect. So I'm over here. Then I parallel transport, and I go up, up, up along the geodesic. So it's still this thing here. It's this thing here. And it's this thing there. So when you are on the top of the thing, it's actually going that direction, the vector, right? And now you parallel transport along this curve. And again, preserving the angle. And you come back over here. This is your V prime. Right? So I have my, well, I first go like this, and then I go like that, and then I go back like that. Right? So what happens is that actually suddenly your vector has rotated from V to V prime. It's not the same anymore. Okay, so V bends to V prime, and they are now very distinct. This is a mathematical expression of the fact that you intuitively think that the Euclidean space is flat, but the surface of the sphere is not flat. Okay, this is, so the fact that you are getting a different thing here is the effect of curvature. So the sphere, the first surface of the sphere, will have non-trivial curvature. It's a curved geometry. It's no longer Euclidean flat nice space. When you have curvature, then as you parallel transport the vectors along closed loops, they will not come to the same vector, but they will rotate. Okay, precisely, this rotation is the definition of the Riemann tensor, so intuitively. So effect of curvature, this is encoded in the Riemann tensor. And how you do this is that really, if you take a loop which goes from one point to another point here, okay, then and you start with a vector v, and you parallel transport this vector v along this thing here, you end up with some new v prime, and there will be delta v between the two vectors v and v prime. So now this delta v mu will be given by the rotation of the vector. So there'll be some rotation here of r mu. Okay, there'll be something here. Mu nu v nu. This is your rotation of the original vector, gives you v prime. But well, I am interested. Well, if this thing here is zero, I want the delta v zero. So I'm doing infinitesimally, if you want. So but anyway, this is some kind of rotation. That's what the definition of the Riemann tensor is. But let's see what this guy might be. So any closed loop, I can approximate that. Let's say, well, I move a little bit by some vector a mu. Then I move a little bit by some vector b mu. And then I move back by a mu. And then I move back by b mu. And then I'm back to my point where I started. So I'm approximating this, you know, nice and smooth closed loop as we go like around this closed loop here, with like going in the direction a mu, then b mu, and then b a mu, and then b mu. It's given by a commutator. So this rotation has to depend on these vectors a and b. So if you feed your Riemann tensor two vectors, a and b, which define what your closed loop in this approximation might be, then this is what the Riemann tensor is. So if you want, the curvature measures, like if you parallel transport vectors along a closed loop, they may not be the same vectors. It will be some rotated vectors, and the curvature measures precisely that. Okay. But what we are doing here is like really a commutator, right? We are doing AB and then minus BA. Right? That's what we are doing. We are going first AB and then minus AB over there, or minus BA. Okay, so this is basically a commutator. But you can always associate these vectors a and b with directional derivatives or with covariant derivatives. So if I replace a mu with nabla mu and b mu with nabla nu, then you expect that this rotation is something like nabla mu, nabla nu, minus nabla nu, nabla mu. Okay, why not? So that motivates a definition of the Riemann tensor. So this was part E, EF, curvature. Measures how much the space-time is curved and let me give you a definition. So because it's intuitively given by this commutator of the covariant derivatives, we will define it this way. So definition, and this is in the absence of torsion. So in absence of torsion, and we will have always metricity equal to zero, Riemann tensor or curvature tensor, Riemann tensor, is defined as, so now you do nabla mu, nabla nu. It's a commutator. It's nabla mu, minus nabla mu, acting on a vector field, V alpha. Okay. And then this will be R alpha, alpha, beta, mu nu, V beta. Okay. This is the definition. That's how you define what a Riemann tensor is. Okay, we'll take 2 minutes break, but let me just take a thing here. So this thing here is two derivatives. So you have two derivatives acting on vector v, right? So now two derivatives, these are covariant derivatives. They are partial derivatives plus gamma, right? So each of them is a partial derivative plus gamma and partial derivative plus gamma. So in principle, the right-hand side, can it have two derivatives? What do you think? If I do partial derivative, and there's another partial derivative, the right-hand side, you would expect it has two derivatives in it. Does it? So very schematically, right? What I'm writing here is partial mu plus gamma mu, partial nu plus gamma mu, gamma nu, minus partial nu plus gamma nu, partial mu plus gamma mu, right? You expect that this to have two derivatives acting on something here. So I have, well, if I have two derivatives, I have d mu, d nu here, but I have minus d nu, d mu. Right? So this is equal to d mu, d nu, minus d nu, d mu. What is that? That is zero, right? Because it's partial derivatives commute. So this is zero. So the right-hand side cannot have two derivatives because of this, because you have a commutator. Right? Can it have one derivative? What do you think? So then I would have, let's say, d mu and then gamma nu, d nu, gamma mu. What do you think? Will that be present there? Can I have a term with one derivative? What will happen is that because you have this anti-symmetrization, what you will have to do is that you will have to anti-symmetrize your gamma indices. When you anti-symmetrize your gamma indices, that will give you torsion. Okay, so then you can have first derivative here. You can have d, but this thing here will give you torsion. Okay, this thing will give you torsion, but I'm saying in the absence of torsion, there's no torsion. So this is zero. So then, finally, you have terms which have no derivatives. No derivatives terms. This acting on this object. That's what I'm writing here. There's the vector v, but it's not differentiated anymore. There's some you know, something here, some tensor standing in front of that. That's what gives you the Riemann tensor. Okay? This is the Riemann tensor. Well, that's the structure of what we are writing here. So in principle, if you do have torsion, there will be another torsion term, which will be torsion times a derivative of v. Right? But because you are setting torsion equal to zero, that term is not there. Let's take a 2-minute break. Questions, comments?
Geodesics.
You can show that if you study geodesics on the sphere, they really, if you have the sphere, it must be the great circles, the largest, the full radius circle, right? And so I'm giving you that information. You have to trust me, but you can calculate yourself that it's the great.
There's like a variational problem hidden inside here.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So you would have to find the geodesics. Either you solve, you know, the parallel transport equation, or you solve, like, I want, you know, thing which minimizes the distance between the two points. So that's like a variational problem, right? You extremize the distance between the two things, and you would find it's great.
And that involves the metric tensor?
Of course it does, yes, exactly. So you need to write down what the metric tensor is on the sphere, and so on. Yes, exactly.
I had a question about the parallel transport. The amount your vector changes depends on the loop.
That's right. So you know what you typically assume is that you think about like infinitesimal loops generated by these like infinitesimal vectors.
Right, so A and B in that example are infinitesimal.
It will be infinitesimal. So this is just a motivation, basically.
Yeah.
Right. So. Okay. Thanks for pointing. Yeah. That's important. Yeah. This is just for motivation. So this is the definition. Right, that is the definition for me.
Okay.
Right, but I was trying to motivate it.
Yeah. I guess I've seen, so when I look online, they do everything in terms of leader reports. So,
okay.
Is this like a, this is kind of a way of formulating sort of?
I'm not sure you can formulate the curvature tensor in terms of lead derivatives. That I'm very surprised. So commutators, certainly you can do.
Yeah.
But let's see. Well, you can do commutators. Well, certainly what is true. But now I will be saying something stupid. So if you have commutator of B and W,
yeah,
right, you can write it in terms of the partial derivatives. So you can use partial derivatives, but you can also replace the partial derivatives with the covariant derivatives. It doesn't matter. So if you define the lead derivative, how is this defined? So you derive it in your tutorial, right? No, you didn't. The commutator. Maybe you did. I would have to. So what you do, Ian, is that you are doing D, W, D, and then you put V. Right. So it must be V. Okay. Let's not write it. But yes, you can replace partial derivatives if you have commutator of two vector fields. You can replace partial derivatives with covariant derivatives. But I'm not sure there. I'll think about it.
Okay, that's fine.
I've never seen it in terms of lead derivatives. Yeah. Yeah.
David?
Yes?
Is there any condition on this, like, killing vector fields? Should it be, like, I don't know, like, nowhere vanishing, or what kind
of... Ah. It can vanish somewhere. You know, that equation, which is somewhere... this equation over here is very, very restrictive. Okay, it's a restrictive. It will not have solutions in any space time. You have to have very special space time, and then you know this equation is still very restrictive. So what you can show, for example, is that typically when you want to know, let's say, a function everywhere, right? We can do Taylor expansion. If you do Taylor expansion, you can say, well, all I need to know about the function is that I take a point, and I need to know what the value of the function at the point is, what the first derivative is, what the second derivative is, what the third derivative is, and so on.
Sure.
Right? So you need to know all kinds of derivatives at that point to give you the function everywhere, right? Or at least it's in some neighborhood.
Yeah, for unending functions, it's true.
Right. For killing vectors, this is not true. All you need to know is the value of the field at that point and its first derivative. And then you already know how the killing vector field looks everywhere. Okay, so it's very, very special, very, very special field. It can vanish somewhere, but you know, if it vanishes and the first derivative vanishes, then it's zero. Then you don't have a solution. So it really it's just the value of the vector field and the value of the first derivative, which gives you everything. Okay. Right, so let's come back and let's play with this Riemann tensor. Okay, yeah.
So do we need to have the notion of a metric or to define Keating fields?
Well, I don't. Well, we even needed it for. Well, I don't know. Certainly, we will definitely have a metric, and you know how you really want to define a Keating field is something that leaves the metric invariant, right? So that's the standard definition of what Keating field is. It's like I want a special vector field, special direction in the space time, which leaves the metric invariant. So definitely, that heavily relies on having the metric. So in the derivation I showed you, maybe the metric only enters in the fact that I am now taking a scalar product between this psi and my geodesic U, right? So the metric is over there, sort of. But it's not obvious from the derivation that you really need metric. Yeah, but you know, what you are really interested in, like in the symmetries of the metric, and that for that notion you definitely need to know what the metric is. Okay, so I was trying to motivate the motivation of the Riemann tensor, well, the definition of the Riemann tensor. But basically what it measures is like the curvature, like how much the space is curved. Okay, in Euclidean space, of course, the Riemann tensor will be zero. And that comes from the fact that if I parallel transport things, I get the same vector. If I am anything which you know, is sort of curved, then the Riemann tensor will not be zero, and then I will have rotated vector over there. Okay. What happens, for example, question. So I told you sphere is curved. We have shown that by picture. What happens with a cylinder? What do you think? If I parallel transport things along the cylinder, parallel transport it up, like that, like that, like that. What do you think? What do you find? It's the same vector, right? If I parallel transport the vector in a cylinder, no matter how I parallel transport it, it will be the same vector. So the curvature of cylinder is actually zero. And that comes from the fact that actually I can always unwind the cylinder this is my cylinder, and I can unwind it, and it will be just, you know, flat Euclidean space, and the curvature of cylinder is actually zero. Okay, so that's so the curvature of cylinder is zero.
What is the curvature of a punctured sphere then? Because if I puncture a sphere, then I can also like...
Oh, yeah, let's not talk about topological effects, okay? Let's not talk about
I have a question about your sketch when you took the derivative set from the for the Riemann tensor. Once we end with the covariant derivative of nu to be alpha, we will have a partial nu plus a gamma. But then our object has two indices, so shouldn't the covariant derivative of nu have a minus gamma as well to account for the second index of grad nu alpha?
Okay, so very good. So you're asking about this expansion in terms of derivatives, right? What I mean is that how many derivatives are left acting on my object, which this covariant derivative is acting on, this commutator is acting on. So this commutator is acting on a vector v. So then I'm asking how many times I have to differentiate my vector v in this question over here. So naively, you might think because there is two derivatives over here, then maybe I need two derivatives there. But actually, it's not true because the partial derivatives are symmetric, and the commutator kills that second derivative. What you can have is a first order derivative, okay? So now you remember that the torsion is something like T alpha mu nu, right? And so this torsion has to act. So this will not work. Will it work? It doesn't work. Okay, let me not write it. But you can have one derivative over here still acting on that vector v, and that will be related to the torsion, okay? And then you can have no derivatives whatsoever acting on vector, and this will be included in the Riemann tensor. So now if you're looking at the things which have no derivatives here, well, there will be terms like gamma times gamma minus gamma times gamma. But there will also be a term where you have a partial derivative, but this partial derivative does not act on v, but rather it has to act on the gamma. So there will be also a term partial of gamma minus partial of gamma. And this is precisely the structure of the Riemann tensor. Okay, so if you unwind this, you will find, so more explicitly, you will find that R rho sigma mu nu is partial of gamma minus partial of gamma plus gamma gamma minus gamma gamma, and let me put the indices. So that's the structure which you expect from over there, and let's put the indices, right? So from the definition of the Riemann tensor, you see that the left-hand side is antisymmetric in mu and nu, right? It's a commutator. It's antisymmetric here. So this guy had better be antisymmetric in mu and nu as well. So how you construct this formula is that this thing here better be antisymmetric. So whenever you have put index mu nu, you have to subtract the index nu mu. Right? That's why minus minus, and that's why minus minus. And the rest, you just put the indices as you want them. So it's d mu gamma nu sigma sigma. That's it. sorry. Rho sigma. And then I have to subtract the same thing, but now with the indices other way around. So it's nu mu rho sigma. Okay, so I just swap these mu and nu. And then you have rho mu lambda lambda nu sigma. So I have mu and nu, and then again you subtract the same thing. It's rho nu lambda lambda mu sigma. Okay, and that's your formula for the Riemann tensor. You cannot get it too wrong, because you always remember this partial gamma plus gamma minus gamma, gamma gamma, and you always have to do that. If you put some term, you have to put the corresponding term with a minus sign where you swap the indices nu and mu because of the antisymmetry. Antisymmetric. What you see here is very interesting. Why is this interesting? Is that the Riemann tensor, of course, we will be in general relativity, where the gammas are just Christoffel symbols, and they are functions of partial derivatives of the metric, right? But if you look at the Riemann itself, I don't need to express it in terms of the metric. I can express it in terms of the correction alone. So basically, I don't need any metric to write down the Riemann tensor here. All I need is to have the connection and make its partial derivatives, and that's it. So this is only depends. Only depends on connection. And that's actually a great simplification for variational problems, as we will do them next week. Okay, just remember that. However, what you can do is that you can lower the index of the Riemann tensor. Okay, so now, why we would be doing that? So remember that when we were discussing the principle of equivalence, I told you, well, I can always introduce a coordinate system so that at a point, my metric looks Minkowski metric. The first derivatives of the metric are zero, or the Christoffel symbols are zero. And could I also make the second derivatives vanishing? Do you remember? Could I also eliminate second derivatives of the metric? So remember when we discuss equivalence principle, we could set g equals to eta at a point, and we could set the first derivatives of the metric equal to zero, equal to gamma. But what about second derivatives? Could we set those equal to zero? Do you remember? Very good. We had like 100 equations to satisfy, but we had only 80 components to tune. So there was like at least, well, It's like 20 left. 20 non-zero left. Okay. So you cannot eliminate all second derivatives. There will be 20 non-trivial left. The statement is the information about these 20 non-trivial components is precisely encoded in the Riemann tensor. These are encoded in Riemann. Okay, so what does that mean? That I claim that this horrible object over here, which looks like it has 4, 4, 4, 4, so many more, 16 times 16 components. In fact, it cannot have 16 times 16 components. It can have at most 20 independent components, which capture precisely the information about these 20 non-trivial second derivatives of the metric. Okay, so from here, well, so it's obvious that the Riemann tensor can be expressed in terms of the metric and the partial derivative metric and the second derivative of the metric. But the statement is it has at most 20 independent components. Okay, if I write down, you know, these Christoffels in terms of the metric, Christoffels have first derivatives of the metric. I am making another derivative here, so it will have second derivatives of the metric, and so it depends on the second derivative, but it has only at most 20 of these. Okay, so this is quite amusing to actually calculate how many components the Riemann tensor has. Okay, and this is amusing. So let's do it. Amusing. Calculate how many components Riemann has. And for that, let's consider a different object. Let's consider just let's lower this first index by using the metric. Okay, so let's define R alpha beta gamma delta to be G alpha kappa R kappa beta gamma delta. I just lowered the first index with the metric. Okay, why not? The metric is non-degenerate. It cannot kill or create new components. Okay, so it's non-degenerate. It's something which is known. So this object will have the same number of components as that object. So let's see how many components this object has. And then what you can show is that this object has very nice symmetries. Well, otherwise, if it didn't have any symmetries, it would have many more components. So we definitely know from the definition that it's antisymmetric when you swap gamma and delta. Okay. What is not obvious at all, and it's called bastard symmetry, is that it's also antisymmetric in the first two indices. Okay, it's also antisymmetric in here. It's not obvious at all, but you can show that it is antisymmetric there, at least if you have Christoffel symbols and stuff like that. So what it means is that if I swap alpha and beta, I'll pick up a minus sign. And here, if I swap gamma and delta, I will pick up a minus sign. There is yet another symmetry. If I take these two indices and these two indices and swap them like this, then it is symmetric here. Symmetric. This is antisymmetric. It's antisymmetric. So what I am saying here is that there is some beautiful symmetries of the Riemann. So symmetries are, so first of all, for example, R alpha beta gamma delta is minus R beta alpha gamma delta. That's one kind of symmetry. It's antisymmetric in the first two indices. But it's also minus R alpha beta delta gamma. I'm swapping the other two indices. OK. But it's also equal to R gamma delta alpha beta. I took these two, and I swapped them. And it's symmetric in that. There's one more symmetry to Riemann, which is quite funny symmetry. If you take Riemann and you antisymmetrize over all indices, you take antisymmetrization. Antisymmetrization typically denoted by these brackets. So symmetrization is these brackets, and antisymmetrization is those brackets. So it means I take R alpha beta gamma delta minus. You do all permutations here with the corresponding sign of the permutation. You will find this is equal to zero. Okay, so if you antisymmetrize over all, antisymmetrize over all indices, then you get zero. And so these are the symmetries of the Riemann tensor. So let's see, what does that mean for how many components the Riemann tensor can really have? Well, I look at my Riemann. Let's say I am in D dimensions. Let's do it in D dimensions, and let's see if that gives 20. In four dimensions, okay? In D dimensions, this is like really mathematical exercise, just to amuse you, right? So I'm saying that if you take these two indices, it has to be antisymmetric. So what happens if I replace these two indices by some capital index A? Okay? Then, you know, each of these indices goes from 0 to d minus 1, so it has d different possibilities. So now if I replace, and this one has d different possibilities, but it's antisymmetric. How many components such an object has? So in other words, if I introduce a new object, a new index A, which replaces these alpha and beta, how many values the capital A can take? Any ideas?
D times d minus 1 over 2.
Precisely. So A takes a combinatorial number d over 2, which is d times d minus 1 over 2. Let's call it n, why not? Values. Right? So the indices alpha and beta cannot really take 4 times 4, but they can at most take 4 times 3 divided by 2, so 6. Six values. What about these two indices here? Well, they have exactly the same antisymmetry. So we can replace them with an index B, and it will also take n values over there. But then I told you that what I can do is that I can take this A and B and write it as B and A. So Riemann is symmetric in A and B indices. How many components a symmetric matrix with A and B indices running from 1 to n values has? If it's symmetric in A and B, so this is the same as R B and A, so that means it has n times n plus 1 divided by 2 components. Okay, so we dealt with these symmetries. Well, this is done. However, there's one more of these symmetries. Okay, which is this one over here. When I antisymmetrize over all possible indices, I have to get zero. how many equations are hiding here? If I'm in d dimensions, then what you are requiring is that if you do anti-symmetrization in four indices, each of them running from 0 to d minus 1, well, d values, then this is 0. That gives you d over 4 combinatorial number constraints. So there are, so this thing here gives d over 4, which is d times d minus 1, d minus 2, d minus 3, divided by 4 times 3 times 2 times 1 constraints. And hence, the total number of components the Riemann tensor can have, so number of components of Riemann is n times n plus 1 divided by 2 minus d over 4, where this n is d over 2. So it's d times d minus 1 over 2. That's what n is. And then we have, again, n d times d minus 1 over 2 plus 1, and then divided by 2. And then minus d over 4, which is written over there. And that's the number of components the Riemann tensor can have. And if you play with this, which I'm not going to do, because it's a one-line calculation, you will find that this is equal to d squared over 12, d squared minus 1. Okay, that's what it is equal to. And if I take d equal to 4, then you have 16 over 12, and then you have times 15, and it should come out to be 20. This is equal to 20 components. So indeed, the Riemann tensor captures the remaining information about second derivatives of the metric. It knows everything about second derivatives. It knows everything about first derivatives, zero derivatives, and second derivatives of the metric. Okay, so I cannot let you have your weekend without introducing the Einstein tensor, so that you would be. So I don't know if you've read Winnie the Pooh. So he has lots of, you know, relations and kins and you know, friends of the rabbit's family. So let's say there are relations. To Riemann, and so if you do, so this is your Riemann tensor, alpha, beta, gamma, delta. So now what you can do is that you can contract the index alpha with one of these three indices, right? So now which one? I cannot choose. I cannot choose beta because it's antisymmetric. If you do trace of the antisymmetric matrix, which has zeros on the diagonal, you get zero. So the only index which I cannot choose is beta. But I can choose either gamma or delta. There are the various conventions how to do that. My convention will be I'm choosing gamma. Okay, so let's contract gamma and alpha. So then that this is called Ricci tensor. R beta delta is equal to R alpha beta alpha delta. And it's called Ricci tensor. If you look at the blackboard up there, the Riemann is entirely written in terms of the connection. Okay. Which means here I just contracted index. So the Ricci tensor is still entirely given in terms of the connection. Still connection only. Okay. Finally, what you can do, if you have the Ricci tensor, you can define Ricci scalar to be R alpha beta G alpha beta. This is called Ricci scalar. Okay. Obviously here, I use metric. So in order to write down the Ricci scalar, yes, you have to use metric. So the Ricci scalar will depend on the metric and connection. So this guy depends on connection only. This guy depends on metric. But what's beautiful here is the dependence on the metric explicitly is just linear. I'm just doing something which is connection dependent, some horrible expression, times linear object in metric. So the dependence is linear on the metric. Okay. Finally, if I have all these objects, you can define Einstein tensor, G mu nu, to be R mu nu, the Ricci tensor, minus 1 half, the Ricci scalar, G mu nu, the metric itself. This is called Einstein tensor. And of course, that's the key object for general relativity. So it's a special combination of the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar, and this is how it looks like. So let me stop here. So now you have basically all the tools you need to have for general relativity. It's one missing piece. This Einstein tensor will satisfy so-called Bianchi identity that nabla mu on g mu nu equals to zero. That's what we used in the first week to construct Einstein equations. So that's the last piece which is missing. You will do it next time. And you will do it in your tutorial. OK, questions? Yes?
We didn't see the metric after this point, I think, because even curvature you can define without the metric.
Exactly. Yeah. So the Riemann tensor or the curvature, in principle, well, if you have Christoffel symbols, well, the metric enters through these Christoffel symbols, right? But I don't need to do it. I can just write this down using the connection only. So there is the expression in terms of the connection only. This will be still true for the Ricci tensor. However, for Ricci scalar, I need to be able to raise one of the indices up and then contract, right? And so Ricci scalar needs a metric.
What does Ricci scalar mean physically?
Well, if you want, this thing here describes, you know, how the vectors rotate and stuff like that. It describes some kind of curvature. This describes just one component of that curvature. It's a very particular component of that, you know, curvature, which is more generally described by this beast with many indices, right? What is beautiful about this thing here is that this thing here is just one number. It's a scalar function. It will be the same in every coordinate system. So Ricci scalar, so that one thing is a tensor. Transform does a tensor, but the components will change as you go from one coordinate system to another. Right? So it may happen, you know, that, well, okay, they change. But Ricci scalar does not. It's the same in every coordinate system, so it's useful. It's one number which tells you something about the curvature.
For 2D, Ricci scalar is Gaussian curvature, right?
Okay, let's not go there. Yeah, well, let's not go there. Yes.
So it's not?
I think it is, yeah. Yep.
Is the geodesic equation invertible? So if we have the equation written for, you know, a manifold, can we say that it has... can we say that it's a geodesic equation? If it's like, so we have an equation which looks like the geodesic equation, right?
Okay.
So it looks like a geodesic equation. Can we interpret, oh, so this looks like a geodesic equation. That means it is a geodesic in a curved manifold, which we don't know of. But it's a, yeah, like.
I'm not exactly sure what you are asking. So certainly, if you find that some vector satisfies the geodesic equation, it will be a geodesic in that manifold, right?
The geodesic equation we did in the first week, I guess, right?
Right.
We had that equation. So if I'm working in a space, with some coordinates, I get that equation, you know, that this equation that some vector satisfies, right? So can I interpret both this? And I don't know that there's a metric. I don't know about that. Okay, I'm not talking about a metric.
Oh, I see. So you're asking whether, you know, the geodesic equation, well, at this point, the geodesic equation did not really know about the metric again, right? So here, what we were saying is that we want something like a generalization of a straight line, right? And that sort of does not depend on the metric. It only depends on the connection. So you don't need to know the metric for that, I think.